Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Nationalist politician Sadr Japarov is back in the office as an elected president of Kyrgyzstan. As he moves in, a number of high-profile politicians are moved out from the political scene, at least on temporary basis, as they are detained on various charges. The number of ministries were cut almost by half, Japarov saying as a reason being that the country doesn't need that many ministries. New ministers consist of some old and some new faces, but all belonging to Japarov's circle of trusted lieutenants. Meanwhile, another round of referendum is planned on constitutional reforms, which expected to land him more power, but he is not waiting for the referendum to be over to put his stamp on what his Kyrgyzstan should look like. So on today's Majlis podcast, we are here to discuss what is it President Japarov has been doing since his election, and what does it all tell us about where he wants to take the nation. To discuss all this, I'm joined by Saniye Toktokazeva, constitutional expert based in Bishkek, Colin Wood, Central Asia writer for The Diplomat, who is currently doing her PhD at Columbia University, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So, let's start, Colin, with you. I was going through your Twitter feed the other day. You had quite a rundown of developments in Kyrgyzstan since Japarov's election. As you mentioned in your tweets, it's been a head-spinning couple of weeks. So what are the high and low lights of those developments from your perspective?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So it's only been a little more than a week since Japarov was sworn in as president, but already so much has happened and so much has changed within the government. As you kind of hinted in the intro, a lot of his efforts have been directed at reshaping Kyrgyzstan's bureaucracy. So it went from 48 executive bodies, so including ministries, but other bodies within the government, from 48 to 16. So just a huge slash and burn of the structure of government. And I think what's hard to analyze about this is, on the one hand, it makes sense from a governing perspective. Kyrgyzstan is a poor country. It is a country that really struggles to deliver public goods and services to its citizens. And having such a bloated bureaucracy is really expensive, ineffective, and leaves ample opportunity for corruption. I think cutting a few of the ministries that they did is problematic. The tourism ministry is gone. The Ministry of Ecology is gone. And for a country where 5% of its GDP depends on tourism, most of which is ecotourism, this could be kind of counterproductive from an economic perspective, in which Japarov has justified this by saying it'll save the government 2 billion soms, about $25 million, to cut this. And another worrying thing in terms of his kind of stated efforts to reshape the bureaucracy is that Japarov announced that in the next 6 months or so, that the role of prime minister is going to be abolished. And so I think this gives us a better hint at the motivation. So I think it's wrong to totally discredit the motivations of streamlining the bureaucracy, saving money. But under previous presidential systems in Kyrgyzstan, there was always a prime minister. So I think that this move this early on to get rid of prime minister and not phrasing it as though it's going through constitutional reform, he announced this on Telegram, suggests that this is more of a power vertical coming into play.
Colin, this announcement about the future of the prime ministry came out from his Instagram post. I mean, is it now official?
It hasn't been made official in any sense. He kind of gave this hint of within the next 6 months. So it's hard to see how this timeline fits onto the referendum timeline. So the Electoral Commission has said that the next referendum is going to be April 11th. But with Japarov saying that within 6 months they'll get rid of the prime minister, that's August. So it doesn't seem clear whether that's something that's going to be folded into the referendum. And kind of it mimics Japarov's strategy that he's had since October of just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks, maybe in a week he'll change his mind. And the new prime minister, Ulukbek Maripov, who kind of has stated in interviews that he doesn't have party loyalties, that he's dedicated to Kyrgyzstan's government, that maybe if Maripov turns out to be pliable or to do what Japarov wants, maybe then we'll see him change his mind.
Saniye, what you are hearing, I mean, I'm, of course, referring to your tweets on the latest developments in Kyrgyzstan. Of course, I would like you go through each of them. I mean, those are really insightful points there. As per the coolness points, especially in terms of the cutting off some departments and ministries, is there anything that stands out to you from that decision?
I think particularly with respect to the reorganization of the government and the way they have started doing it right now, it's really alarming because we're still de jure living under the 2010 constitution. So the fact that we had the referendum on January 10th doesn't mean that the former constitution was annulled and we are automatically moving to the presidential form. Not at all. So procedurally and formally, all the requirements must have been fulfilled. But despite this fact, we see that the way how the new government is being formed, that it looks like more formality from this side of the parliament, but clearly an active involvement of the president. However, according to the constitution, president de jure still do not have the right to form the government. It's within the basically prerogatives of the Jogurku Kinges. But it already means that generally the narrative and the mood in Kyrgyzstan, it's like as if we had already adopted a new constitution. But generally, I think it is also important to highlight the facts or the gross violations that are happening around the constitutional reform, particularly like from the beginning, the group of lawyers, we have been insisting that the sixth convocation of parliament, it's illegitimate. They have artificially extended their term by passing the law on October 22nd. And plus, not only they have extended their term, but they have started a constitutional reform. However, according to the constitution, they don't have right to do that because they have term have expired already. And it was confirmed by the Venice Commission in their amicus curiae. But then we also have a de facto replacement and substitution of the entire text of the constitution, not an amendment. However, according to the rules of our current constitution, we only can introduce amendments. We cannot substitute or replace it entirely, which is already a second gross violation. Right. And then the third is the constitution of the Constitutional Assembly that was done by the acting president, Talant Mamutov. He did not have the right to do so because according to the constitution, president do not have the right to initiate constitutional reforms. So, and then the draft constitution, perhaps we will talk about this content later. Mm-hmm. It contains a lot of proposals that are generally incompatible and not accepted under the democratic states. It has a lot of serious conflicts and contradictions at large. Mm-hmm. And I think the outrageous things that is currently happening is several weeks ago, a number of MPs have initiated a draft law which allows them to adopt the law on appointing the referendum on amendments to the constitution without public hearing and in three readings simultaneously. Hmm. So which means they're going to completely deprive our constitutional right to have a public hearing to discuss the constitution, which is really unacceptable what they're doing.
Very interesting. You know, Kyrgyzstan is a very, very interesting topic. And of course, there is always a lot to talk about. I'm sure we will end up skipping many important topics today, as our intention is to wrap up the discussion within 35, 40 minutes. So it will be great if we keep our comments brief on that. Bruce, let me bring you in here. It looks like the way Sonia and Colin explained, and the constitutionality of decisions kind of pushed back, it seems to me, the way Jabarov is kind of moving ahead with all these head-spinning decisions. So the same question to you, in fact. I mean, what stands out to you among the decisions that he has taken over the past week or so?
Yeah, I mean, you were right by saying it's happening so fast, and it's just really confusing to figure out where he's going. Yeah, well, obviously, you can see he wants all the power and stuff. But I mean, he's suggesting, as Sonia pointed out, some of this isn't formalized yet. But he's suggesting all these changes, radical changes in the way the whole country is run. And at the meantime, there's all these questions about the legality, legitimacy of these decisions. I'm like, this is like planting landmines along your route or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't help but think that a lot of this is going to come back in a few months where people start to say, wait a minute, how exactly did that get passed again? And what was the process there? You know, other aspects of his rule that have kind of been disturbing to me was, of course, the detention of a lot of politicians, two of whom were presidential candidates in the last election, too. You know, this in the run-up to his actual inauguration, you know, three fairly prominent figures, the former head of the Security Service, former deputy interior minister, the former prime minister, and, you know, and some of the charges against him, in the case of the former security chief, Sergei Zbayev, there's probably some legitimacy to that, but the timing was real bad with that. The charges against the former deputy interior minister, Kursan Asanov, as far as I could tell, was that allegedly he seized the interior ministry building in Bishkek when, in fact, the guy that was in charge of trying to keep law and order at the time told him to go and do that. It seems like a ludicrous charge. And all this happened in, you know, in bam, 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 3 days before his inauguration. And since then, you know, they've been detaining people too. Well, another former prime minister and deputy just yesterday. So there's that aspect to it. And then his idea about mining, you know, that he declared that from now on, no foreign companies would be able to get mining rights in Kyrgyzstan, but the ones that did have their licenses could keep their rights and they could still continue mining. That sounds like a pretty dubious promise already. But in the meantime, I understand that mining is unpopular in Kyrgyzstan. I know the people take the land, you know, preserving the land real seriously and stuff. But realistically, they've been talking about domestic investment in the mining industry in Kyrgyzstan for more than a decade, and it just is not going to happen. You know, and it's one of the only parts of their economy that they can really kind of count on for some reliable money. You know, so I don't know where he's going with that. And like I said, after he said no more foreign companies, if I was a foreign company that was operating in the country, I would be concerned about what my future was. And this is certainly a bad investment climate for anyone looking into Kyrgyzstan and trying to figure out if they want to sink money into some project.
Yeah. Bruce, can I draw your attention into the points that earlier Colin was raising in terms of the cutting off those departments and ministries? Is there anything stands out to you there in terms of what ministries he's cutting off or the departments he's cutting off, and does it show anything about his intentions going forward?
Tourism, yeah, I agree. Yeah, well, why would you cut the tourism ministry? You know, that's Kyrgyzstan has been billing itself for this great place, and they've been getting a lot of good publicity in international journals too about what a great place it is, you know, and come and visit. You know, I mean, generally, when I heard he was cutting ministries, I just kind of shook my head. And they've done this, I don't even know how many times. Someone comes in, they cut the ministries, they add some back, or take one that's been cut and combine it now with an existing ministry or something. So this, it's like inhaling and exhaling, almost, you know. I think it's temporary.
So you think it's temporary?
You know? I don't, like I said, they've done this before. But that's always one of the solutions to cutting government spending.
So temporary in a sense that the next government might restore those ministries. But,
you know, like I said, even this government, depends on how long this government lasts, but even this government could rethink that and decide that they're going to combine, you know, the tourism ministry with you know, the financial ministry or something like that all of a sudden. Kind of bring it back, put it in a position where it could become a full-fledged ministry again later. But like I said, I've seen this. I've seen them do this before.
His reasoning being like, Kyrgyzstan doesn't need too many ministries. What was that, 22 or something? So Kyrgyzstan doesn't need that many. Maybe he is right. But he was also saying, like, more similar decisions in the pipeline. At least this is what I get a hint from his comments, that more might be in the pipeline going forward. Colin, what was your reading into that aspect?
Yeah, I think it seems like, you know, his announcement of this was a Facebook post in which he used his phone to take a picture of two pieces of paper, kind of mapping out the bureaucracy with handwritten notes before and after in Kyrgyz. So it doesn't strike me that it would be that hard to just print out a new map of a new bureaucracy setup. Or I guess your question of, like, which ministries stick out to you? And looking at the map, it seems like there's a lot
just trying
on
to make just trying to
security.
Yeah, just trying to make logic of what he's really doing, I mean, with those ministries.
Yeah, so a lot of the ministries that are there, it's health, it's internal security, it's internal justice. That it doesn't strike me as super surprising then that this anti-corruption campaign of arresting former politicians, it seems to map onto itself. And I think similarly with, you can read the restructuring of bureaucracy either as a streamlining governance or as this more cynical creation of a power vertical. I think that you can read the arrests of these former authorities in a similar way. I think that it's not a lie to say that people who are being arrested on charges of unlawful enrichment or embezzlement, And it's not a stretch to say that in the game of like magical chairs that high-level bureaucrats play in Kyrgyzstan over the last 20 years, you know, many are probably implicated in shady dealings, and these calls for lustration are not out of the blue. So both things can be true, that there's fighting corruption, whether it's genuine or whether it's just revenge motivated or just for the optics, it works. But I think what's more worrying, and I hope that Sonia can follow up here, and I'd be curious for her take, is I think that the more worrying arrests and detentions are at bloggers and journalists. So the PR rep who worked for Sigisbayev during his campaign for president was brought in for questioning at the GKMB, like, and was potentially being charged with inciting inter-ethnic or religious hatred, I think. And we've seen this before, the misuse of this specific charge to silence dissidents and journalists.
Sonia, is there anything you would like to add into comments by Colin, especially on the putting pressure on various ways on bloggers, on citizen journalists or media or civil society in Kyrgyzstan?
I absolutely agree with the that this is one of the most worrying signs. What has happened like a few days ago with the bloggers. So there was the search and seizure and potential article that is going to be used against them. It's the interracial and religious hatred. This is really problematic article in criminal code. As for the basically merger of all these ministries, I think one of the important thing that we need to also carefully look at is the merging of the governmental register office with the Ministry of Interior. And we noticed that a lot of militarization of civil governmental units that civil society of Kyrgyzstan has fought for so many years. And we have achieved this civilization of the governmental units. But now, again, going back to this militarization, this is really terrible, because within the Ministry of Interior, when all this GRS and other parts of the government were part of, particularly issuing the passports, there was a huge corruption schemes. And I really doubt that this is a good idea to bring it back again. And frankly speaking, sometimes I have an impression that Sadr Shaparov wants just to rehabilitate all this governmental structure while he was working during Bakiev, before he went to prison. Maybe this is the only governmental structure that he knows and he got used to work with. So we don't know. But I personally don't see any logic behind them other than the attempt to basically concentrate the power around himself and create this power vertical. And this is really worrying.
To follow up on what you have been saying, like most of his decisions, aside from the legality of that, often appears to be kind of populist. How the reaction has been so far by the people to the changes that has taken place?
The reaction was very different. Like the mostly progressive side of the population have taken it in a way of ridicule, and we see a lot of memes coming up with all these decisions about merging and remerging of the ministries. But majority of his supporters, they like this populistic idea. They believe that he's doing it in order to fill kind of this deficit in the budget, that they believe that we don't need all these ministries at all. But this is not how reforms actually work. You cannot make reform by cutting ministries, right? And merging the ones that cannot be merged at all. But I think now we have this euphoria in Kyrgyzstan, especially around his supporters, and he does really have this, especially in the regions, a big support. But he's keep making these populistic promises over and over again. And I don't know to what extent he will be capable of fulfilling all those promises, because sooner or later, this basically euphoria will end, right? And the people will start demanding some changes. So far, he believes like as soon as we adopt the new constitution, he will start working and etc. But we all know that the problem is not in the constitution.
We call it in our language like a honeymoon period. It should be over at some point. His reasoning behind some of the decision, at least, was, as I said, streamlining the structure of the government and for the purpose of efficiency. When you dive deeper a little bit, you have so many questions, as you guys have raised during this conversation. So how to read all these actions in entirety? What does that tell us about what is ahead and what all those might mean for Kyrgyzstan going forward? Let's continue the podcast talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate. Today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Saniye Tokhtugaziyeva, constitutional law expert, joining us from Kyrgyzstan, Bishkek, Colin Wood, Central Asia writer for The Diplomat, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are trying to make sense of President Japarov's early steps after his election as the president. So, let's start with you, Colin. So, given all these, his early steps that we have been talking about, when you put all of them together in one basket, I'm trying to put you in the box of a sociologist, maybe, here. So, what kind of Kyrgyzstan he appears to envision?
Yeah, it's funny that you asked the political scientists at first, that I think a lot of social scientists are loath to make concrete predictions. But I think what I would say about his strategy and what we can maybe predict out in the next few months or year is that I wrote this in a piece for The Diplomat, that his strategy can be summed up as throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what falls down onto people's ears. Yeah. Borrowing from the Russian phrase that to put noodles on someone's ears is to like trick them or lie to them or deceive them.
That's a tactic. That's a tactic, Collins. Yeah.
But that's his tactic.
The bigger picture behind that. What he's really thinking, what drives him?
You know, what has struck me about listening to a full range of experts on Kyrgyzstan has been a kind of unified puzzlement over the origin of his wild rise to power, the motivations of his wild rise to power. I think what's really interesting about Japarov is how he's using discrete political tactics in different regions of the country. When he was going to southern oblasts on his tour while running for president, well, I guess technically he was still president, so he wasn't officially campaigning at that point, but it was effectively a campaign visit. He's kind of talking about the unity of the regions, all seven oblasts are one Kyrgyzstan. Making claims to Soviet-era leaders who made a big deal to kind of emphasize the Kyrgyzstan-ness of the nation. But then when he is in Issyk-Kul, his home region, he's really leaning into the kind of native son element, as Oksana Ismailbekova wrote for an Open Democracy piece. So I think the fact that he is able to wear different hats and kind of like different narratives over belonging in Kyrgyzstan, he gets that there isn't a kind of single populist or like ethno-nationalist message that's going to work in all corners of the country, which shows a really like savvy, if not worrisome, strategy. But so I think what makes it difficult is the inclusion of all of these kind of social norms to be enshrined in the Constitution. Granted, all that we have to look at or judge this based on is the 61 amendments that were first put forward back in November. We're not 100% sure if those specific amendments are going to be what the new Constitution looks like when people vote on it. But a lot of those included things of trying to put into law, you know, the social mores of the Kyrgyz nation. And I think when trying to cross from, you know, the Constitution as a legal document, as a legal field, into the Constitution as a document that enshrines Kyrgyz stateness and Kyrgyzstan nationhood is where trouble starts to come in. Although I think that I'd be curious to hear what Saniye has to say more of this, that the one thing that makes me not view this as entirely terrible or kind of recalling back to the 2010 events is that Japarov himself, maybe his teammates, some of the people who are in his circle, are more aggressively ethno-nationalist. But Japarov himself has not really been campaigning on pro-Kyrgyz or pro-Northern vibes, that he is really aware about kind of a united Kyrgyzstan, one that is for social conservatism, one that is for streamlined government. But I think it's yet to be seen like what flavor of populism is going to be showing up in the Constitution.
Interesting. And Saniye, on the emphasize on Kyrgyzness, I think this is something came up recently. I don't know whether he is driving that conversation or maybe people look at him like, you know, there is a term which often used in our conversation, like in the previous episodes, like when you think of a Kyrgyz man, that type of person comes to your mind. I mean, where this discussion is coming up, who's driving this?
It is really difficult to answer to this question since I'm a lawyer. But I think particularly when we talk about general political strategic tools that Sadır Japarov is using, is he always says one thing and does completely different thing, unfortunately. And I'm still surprised why his supporters haven't noticed that already. For instance, from the beginning, even before he became the acting president, acting prime minister, his main narrative and the message was that, you know, I am about the law. And even in inauguration, he said that in Kyrgyzstan, I'm planning to establish dictatorship of the law, you know. So it sounds really good. But then every single his move proves completely the opposite, right? Every single move from the October is actually violating the law nonstop. And plus, he's manipulating this narrative very good at the same time, because all of a sudden, in one day, now anyone who is about actively basically coming up or speaking up about constitutionalism or saving rule of law is automatically labeled, you know, like Westerner, or he uses this word like buzuqular, akmaktar, so it's as if like this enemy of the people. And this language is very dividing people. Like, however, president by the constitution, he's the symbol of unity. He must unite people. And this is, I think, very destructive right now, because Kyrgyzstan is really polarized. If before, like, we had division by the regions and then the rural places and the Bishkek and etc., now all of a sudden we have this, you know, enemies of people, Westerners, and then the real patriots who care about Kyrgyzstan and etc. He's like successfully using this manipulative tool, unfortunately, and now, like many people, when you talk about them about rule of law and constitutionalism, they don't hear that at all. They don't see the relevance. They believe like all this 30 years law never worked. Why we should care about it? So that's why this is really, and I agree with Colin that he's smartly using all these strategies. Yeah. We've never had such a president before using all these strategic, political, technological tools so effectively. That's why it makes it so difficult to understand or find out the root cause, you know, who is behind him, or what is it that he really wants, or where is it that he's heading Kyrgyzstan to?
That's kind of million-dollar question that we have been asking since his rise to power. Bruce, when it's a tough game, that what we are doing now, let's try to read his brain as to his motivation from the perspective of the type of people that he is going after in terms of detaining, and the type of slogans that Sanya mentioned, he's putting out, like polarizing slogans. So what does all these tell us about his motivation, about his future plans, about where he sees Kyrgyzstan going forward?
Wow, you know, that's a tough one. Every time as often as I read stuff that he says anyway, I'm always trying to figure out how long he really thinks he's going to be there. You know, that's like my big question when I look at whatever he says and stuff. You know, is he think he'll be there 10 years or 11 years or whatever? Or, you know, what is it? You know, I'm still, even at this point, right, he was elected president, but I'm more interested in the people that put him there, and I'm trying to figure out what their game is and all this. Now, right, certainly he comes off as like a, you know, what you were saying, the Kyrgyz Jigit. I mean, this is like an authentic Kyrgyz person here that's everything. We know there was a lot of dissatisfaction with politics in Kyrgyzstan, you know, generally over 30 years. But I mean, just in the last few years, you know, the bickering between Atambayev and Jeenbekov, and you know, it just goes on and on. So I kind of understand where the people wanted, like we heard lustration. They want to see someone new that they hadn't seen before. And this guy's certainly new. You know, he doesn't wear suits. You know, he shows up at public gatherings and he's dressed better than people at the public gatherings, but generally the same kind of clothing, just better made and from a foreign manufacturer. You know, he plays the whole game. And I know he says, you know, give us time, give us 6 months at least to try to get reforms going and stuff. But I just, every time I look at him, I'm like, how long do you really think you're going to be there? You know, you're storming through policies, but is he real confident? And like I said, the people who put him there, are they real confident he's going to last? Or is this, are they playing for time, or what's going on? You'd like to think since he was elected, he would at least serve out his term. I mean, it would be good for the country, I suppose, too. But I just keep getting the sense that he's pressing all this stuff. He's playing the national, you know, that I'm your homeboy kind of card, and changing stuff a lot. And people like that because some people were tired with the old system and tired with the old politicians. So, like, he's a new guy. He's going at changes right away and stuff. But I just keep looking at him and going, do you really think you're going to be here in 3 years? And I'm not sure, you know, so I don't know.
Yeah, Yeah,
if he has a vision for Kyrgyzstan long term.
Yeah, and
to tell you
that. Yeah, on that earlier, Colleen, again going back to your tweets, you were talking about the mysteries surrounding the draft constitutional document that Kyrgyz people will be voting on April 11th, I guess. So of course there is a mystery part of that, but again, when you put that project into the mystery that we are talking about, his intentions, his motivations in terms of where he is trying to take Kyrgyzstan, where that constitutional draft fits into this question?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what's interesting about the constitutional draft and that makes it really hard to fight against is that in Kyrgyzstan, or at least the setup for this one, is going to be that people are going to have to vote on the amendments as a whole. So thinking back to the 2016 referendum that included a handful of measures to kind of, I guess that the framing then was like dictator-proof the country, continuing to try to build parliamentarism, continuing to try to limit the powers of the president. You know, although they were, I think, at the time disingenuous, given Atambayev trying to protect himself. But hidden in there were also a handful of measures on, you know, marriages between a man and a woman, like these more social things. And that people who maybe wanted to vote for the political procedural measures, but didn't want to vote for the social measures were stuck because there was no mechanism for them to choose between them. And so I think what's going to be really hard to disentangle when trying to analyze the upcoming constitution is that maybe a handful of the amendments might on their face read well, but it's so easy to get tied up in the content of it, of like, okay, well, this isn't that bad on the whole. There are some really worrying social things that were snuck in there that people don't have the power to vote on. But getting caught in the content totally allows people to forget that the entire procedure and process of this was botched. There was no transparency over it. There was not done according to the rules of the game that were written in the prior constitution. So I think more worrying than the content here in trying to analyze, like, what is Japatov's rule going to look like, is that the procedure is really defining. Like, he's not someone who's playing by the rules of the game, and he's manipulating them from the inside to serve his interests. And I think Bruce is exactly right in saying, you know, maybe he is looking back at the number of prime ministers and the number of presidents in Kyrgyzstan and how they've all gone down. And even though he's only been sworn in for a week, he's already thinking about his exit strategy or what it looks like to leave the presidency. So I think procedurally, creating a precedent for just announcing things on Telegram and maybe they'll become law, for announcing things that he wants to happen and then putting pressure on parliamentarians to make it happen, that all of these kind of extra legal procedural things becoming normalized, I think maybe is what we can start to expect from the country. And that to me is where it's really concerning, is that it's the whims of a single person at the top of a pyramid. And that is super worrying, especially for someone who does not appear to have a set cohesive or coherent strategy. I think it's going to get really hard to govern the country in a fair way.
So what worrying is also, earlier Sonia was talking about the draft, the constitutional draft, the document itself. So Sonia, you are saying that there are full of questionable element in the content of the draft, and then tell us about the content and also talk through the legality of the process in the way he is pushing it.
So at the beginning, I have mentioned some of the parts of the legalities. And currently now, I think what brings a lot of illegitimacy to the process is that the text of the constitution is kept super secret. Neither constitutional assembly nor parliament is not willing to make it public. And we have no idea why they're doing that. It's either because they know that, again, the civil society would start criticizing it or what. So it's already. And the way how Constitutional Assembly was working was the format was completely not fulfilling the overall established standards, because Constitutional Assembly never works with already like ready drafts. The assembly must draft the constitution itself, but it was already developed and they were just editing. And there were even some signs that indicated that probably even the final editing was not made by the Constitutional Assembly, but rather by the lawyers from presidential apparatus, because there were a number of members of Constitutional Assembly who have said that they, up until the last plenary session, they have never seen the final draft at all, or they have seen but only the blocks where they were working. And when we were demanding to publicize that, many of the Constitutional Assembly members said that they just don't have the draft, or they have signed some document which said that they cannot basically make it public. So this already puts a lot of question, because the main job of the Constitutional Assembly is to legitimize this process and to boost the legitimacy of the Constitution, but what they're doing is completely opposite. As for the content, the biggest problem is that they are now reviving all the powers of the presidents that we have get rid of in 2010, which have been absolutely abused by Akayev and Bakiyev, which were the root causes of 2005 and 10 events, which is the right of the president to call for a referendum. Now it is there because we, the group of lawyers, have got this, secretly got the draft text, and we don't know whether it is final draft or not, but it seems like it is final. So second thing, they're reviving another power of the president that Bakiyev and Zakayev had, and they have loved using that a lot. It's the legislative initiative of president. So which means now the president would be controlling the legislative agenda of the parliament. And the powers of the parliament has been decreased substantially to the minimum. They don't take any part in forming the government. They cannot basically express vote of no confidence. So they're just simply left with legislative power. Even there, a president will be controlling it. Except for president, the draft text of the constitution says that the legislative power will be given to Narodny Kurultai and the general prosecutor, which is insane. Like, why Narodny Kurultai and the general prosecutor? And the another problem of the indication of the absence of effective system of checks and balances is the control of the president over the judiciary and security bloc. According to the text, president will be appointing the chief justice of both Supreme Court and Constitutional Court, which again shows that in this context, we will never have a judicial independence, because when there is no effective system of checks and balances, then there is no judicial independence. And as for the human rights and freedoms parts, now they have a completely different chapter dedicated to spiritual and cultural foundations of society. We don't know what does it mean. And then there are a number of possibilities of limiting the access to the information. The Constitution says that it can be basically denied, and all this will be regulated by law. And it says that certain activities or distribution of this information can also be limited according to the law, which seems like the censorship. And most importantly, the Article 23 on General Limitation Clause don't have any mention about absolute rights, which we have under our current text of the Constitution, the huge list of absolute rights, which says that they cannot be limited at all, but they have basically omitted all this absolute rights. Mm-hmm. So there are many, many such things, but I think the biggest highlight is that there is no effective system of checks and balances and a lot of concentration of power around a president.
So talking in legal terms, Sania, once this goes through on April 11th, is there anything can be done about this within the legal framework? Or
like, after it passed, of course, we would have no choice but to live with that constitution. But I doubt that it will be for that long. Maybe it is already laying the foundation for the next upheaval or whatever. But now we still have an opportunity to demand the parliament actually to stop their initiative, so that we would have the public hearing. So there is still possibility to demand to send the draft to the Venice Commission, Constitutional Chamber. But I think it is less likely going to happen, because they're doing their best to have it in April together with the elections to the local self-governance. Because if they do it separately, no one, I think the 30% threshold won't show up. Like, it's for sure, because the presidential election, they just barely met the threshold. So they will streamline it, and because it's nothing new, they have been doing it from October. But by this, we should understand that they're just destroying the constitutional order, and this is a very bad sign, because the biggest problem of all these events in Kyrgyzstan, all the so-called revolutions, were the constant change in amendments to the constitution.
Right. Now, on that, Bruce, just a final thought on the constitutional discussion. I mean, how do you read this secrecy around the draft? I mean, what does it tell you?
Well, you can't think that it's something good, that's for sure. You know, I mean, like Sonia said, this has to be open for public discussion. Sometimes the people got to see what's there. Well, you can't vote on something if you don't know what's there, right? You know, what do they got in it that's so bad? They're going to have to publish it sometime. You asked me once if I thought the referendum would pass, and I said every referendum in Central Asia has always passed, and not just Kyrgyzstan. There's never happened when it was voted down. So you can forget about maybe people will vote it down. That won't happen. But in the meantime, once it's published, at least some aspects of it might prove to be so unpopular that they amend them or water it down or something like that. But you know, sadly, I got to agree with Sonia on this one, that they're doing everything they can to have a repeat of the 2005 and 2010 revolutions. This is a disastrous direction they're headed in. Mm-hmm. I can understand, like I said, I understand public discontent about the way politics was running the last few years in Kyrgyzstan, but what they're opting for has already proven to be a not an acceptable solution for the Kyrgyz people. It's like watching a train wreck coming or something, almost, for me anyway. No.
Yeah, again, you know, constitutional referendum or the type of decisions that he is taking these days in terms of restructuring or streamlining the government, as he says it, Kyrgyzstan is going through lots of other challenges. So let's see how much of a honeymoon period he has and what the ultimate reaction might end up being by the people. So I think we also need to conclude the discussion right here. Just a very final question. So where our eyes should be? That's the question I always ask at the end of our conversation. So where our eyes should be, or where your eyes will be, Colin, going forward as to what comes next?
Yeah, my eyes are kind of spread out. I'm watching a lot of social media. I mean, I'm in New York City, so I'm far, far away from Kyrgyzstan, and I'm, you know, frustrated with that, but I'm kind of continuing to watch things develop on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook. And I think that trying to keep a balanced social media diet, if you will help, I think, to kind of avoid the mistakes of a lot of analysts in trying to understand the October unrest. It's not quite right to call it a revolution directly, but yeah, unrest, political crisis, that I think people had gotten used to seeing Instagram and TikTok and Twitter as spaces where, you know, political activism was happening, where discussions of protests were happening, that people overlooked, in many cases, Facebook as a space where Kyrgyzstanis are talking about politics. So in trying to understand or to get a pulse on how people are reacting to these measures or reacting to the proposals about the new bureaucratic map, are reacting to the new constitution, I guess I'm less interested directly in the way that elites and the president are talking about it, but in how it's being received, to try to maybe understand or predict whether there will be, you know, unrest like we saw in October, as Bruce was describing, being inevitable, which I think is pretty right on the nose. Yeah, so I'm trying to understand what everyday people are, you know, making sense of politics in Kyrgyzstan.
Right. Okay, if you guys want to say something briefly, Sonia and Bruce, again, on the same question, is there any particular thing or things that you will be looking at, watching at in a couple of weeks to come or months to come?
So definitely my eyes will be in the process of constitutional referendum. And besides that, I think we should be aware of the fact that right after the referendum, number of big laws would be adopted, particularly the law on elections of deputies, the law on constitutional court, and etc. And this is where most important things will be decided. Because constitution, the way how I look at this draft, it has a lot of provisions which says that this would be regulated by law. For instance, it says that only 90 deputies in parliament, but it doesn't say by which system. So which means it would be regulated by law. And I think number of drafts are already there, particularly on the law and constitutional court and etc. So definitely my eyes would be on them. Because most of the time people don't pay attention to that. But the real problems are actually within the law. So that definitely I would be watching them and entirely the constitutional referendum and the process, and the way how all these laws are drafted, by whom they're initiated. So this would be my priorities to upcoming months.
Right. Bruce, any last word from you?
Socioeconomic conditions, without a doubt. I think that's where it'll, you know, you guys promised a lot, but at the end of the day, you can't fool people. They already hinted the other day that they're probably going to start increasing utility rates 10%. They might have to do it 10% every year. You know, that's the people. Some of the people that voted for him were thinking he was going to wave a magic wand and everything would be all right. This is going to be a tough year. The coronavirus, you know, like I said, he's some of the things he's done are toxic for foreign investment. So he's going to have a hard time there. They already are donor dependent. It's going to become even more so. And if they can't provide the basics for people, I think that it'll snap real quick.
Right. Okay. With this, unfortunately, we have to conclude the conversation here. Thank you very much, Bruce Fanier, the editor of Freedom for Europe, Freedom Liberty, Central Asia Bloc, Shlakuwazi. And big thanks goes to Sania Tokhtagazieva, constitutional law expert, who is joining us from Bishkek today, and Colin Wood, a Central Asia writer for The Diplomat, and currently doing her PhD at Columbia University. Again, thank you very much for your time and thoughts today, colleagues. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.